You know, the online world is great for so many things. It's great for making you laugh, it's great for entertainment, and every now and again you come across ideas or people that literally blow your mind. But I still think some of our best thinking happens offline. So join me, Nessa, on Offline Thoughts as I chat about some of the things I think about when I'm not online. I'm really glad you're listening, and I hope you enjoy the episode. So in today's episode, I'd like to talk about something that has honestly occupied more time than it maybe deserves, and that's the beef between Drake and Kendrick that started back in March. And for anybody who hasn't kept up with it, because they probably have better things to do with their lives, it started when, I mean, it's probably been longstanding in that obviously both people didn't like each other for a very long time. But as far as the public is concerned, when the beef officially started was in March of this year, when Kendrick was on a song called Like That, where he didn't directly actually reference Drake. He just talked about how he was basically like rap's top, probably like rap rapper or artist. But it was very much in the vein of just like a rapper being braggadocious about being the best in the game, which, you know, we see all the time. So it wasn't anything out of the ordinary or anything that you would say warrants sort of like the initiation of the beef that came to be. Now, for some reason, Drake takes it upon himself to see this as a diss directly against him and his, I guess, standing in the rap game, which, by the way, even the fact that he's considered a rap star or like a rap artist, it kind of annoys me. But anyway, so he hears a song and he basically thinks, and he says to himself, like, you know, I'm not going to take that. And he uses this as an opportunity to release a song called Push Ups, which basically is coming for Kendrick. And I mean, technically he didn't actually release the song. The song was leaked, but it feels very much like it was leaked in the way that celebrities like leak their sex tapes now. So it was blatantly designed to sort of test what the public would feel about the lyrics and then claim it if it went down well. Now, the reason why we know is sort of like wasn't like an old record that was taken and leaked against his will is that when it's released, he doesn't come out and say, hey, this was me like playing around. I didn't actually mean to release this. Somebody stole this and released this against my will. It was just something I was playing around with in the studio. He didn't say any of that. He actually goes ahead and releases like this kind of whack AI track a couple of weeks later that is again coming explicitly for Kendrick. So at this point, it's basically war. Now, after Drake releases his song, like, you would expect that Kendrick's people would have been like rallying him to like respond straight away. But actually, Kendrick takes his sweet time and he doesn't come back until like over a month later. And he comes back with like a 6-minute track that's called Euphoria. And if you don't know, Euphoria is a show that is the namesake of the show that Drake produces. And I haven't actually watched the show because it's probably not within... I'm probably not the target audience, but it's basically like a high school drama that features lots of teenagers. And the reason why the show is kind of scandalous is that it kind of features a lot of sex scenes, which is inappropriate or a bit weird, shall we say, considering all of the people in the show are basically like teenagers who are sub 18. And not the actors, like, as we know, like the actors who play teenagers are like usually in like their mid 20s or even 30s. But, you know, like most of them, maybe not most of them, but from the clips that I've seen, certainly the girls do look like youthful or young, and they're intended to look young. So, you know, it's one of those shows where they've really pushed the envelope of what's sort of acceptable TV viewing when they're depicting teenagers. So, you know, this is sort of a prelude, like Kendrick releasing the song that's called Euphoria, that's the namesake of Drake's show, is a prelude basically of what's to come, because Kendrick then goes on to basically say that Drake is a predator in no uncertain terms. I mean, he pretty much says it in every record that he releases after that fact. But yeah, so Euphoria is the first response, and it is a response that feels like disproportionate, shall we say, to Drake's initial release of Push Ups, because Push Up is like a diss track that's basically saying like, I make more money than you, your label is basically like cheating you, you're short, you've got like small feet. It's kind of light touch. And when he comes out with Euphoria, he comes back and he says like, you're a predator. So already from an outsider looking in, from the public's perspective, like, it's gone up two notches. It's been escalated in a way that probably nobody expected. So that's the first part. That's the first part of an intrigue, at least for me, is that the fact that he came out and just was so blatant in his accusation of Drake being a predator was kind of like something that we don't see. Like, we're used to seeing or hearing rappers like accuse each other of being like simps or weak or poor, which is kind of terrible actually, or otherwise just not being at the top of their game. I don't know if we're used to hearing like rappers accuse other rappers of being like rapists, for example, or being like pedophiles, for example. I just don't think we're used to hearing that, or at least I had never heard that. So already it was interesting from a public perspective in that it was a salacious piece of accusation and we were kind of waiting to see what Drake would say in response. But the thing is that Kendrick doesn't even give Drake the opportunity to respond, because almost immediately he follows up the Euphoria song with another song called 616 in LA. In that song, he's basically talking about how Drake, you know, didn't really have a childhood that was filled with acceptance, and that a lot of his childhood was characterized by the fact that he was always trying to fit in, that he didn't have sort of like the close-knit friendships that are kind of instrumental in shaping people's character, and that that's perhaps an explanation for why he is the way that he is. Another thing that he says on this track again, which again is a prelude to what's to come, is he also basically says that he's getting a lot of the information about Drake from Drake's very own people, which means that inside Drake's camp, there are people who are disloyal to him because they dislike him. And the reason why they dislike him is because he's not a good person. And remember that point, because I'm going to talk about it when I conclude the episode about why that's relevant. So after 616 in LA, Drake comes back and he releases this song called Family Matters. And in the song, he's definitely like, it's less light touch than Push Ups and the AI song that he released. And in this one, he's basically accusing like Kendrick of being a wife beater. He says that, you know, he's been with the mother of his children for a very long time. He still hasn't married her. He implies that the reason why he hasn't married her is because he doesn't actually want to marry her, that he's having all these affairs on her, and that's why he keeps an apartment in New York or LA, I forget exactly where. And then also the most probably incendiary thing that he says on this track is that he says that Kendrick beats his girlfriend, or he beats his partner. And this is kind of a departure for Drake, who's, you know, usually kind of talks about like light touch stuff, and he talks about them in a very poppy way. This track is actually 8 minutes long, and it's probably an attempt at trying to match the energy that Kendrick came out with when he released Euphoria. The problem though is that when Drake releases Family Matters, is that his camp and his team probably expected the public to be able to digest what he said on that track, and that that would win him some kind of favor or at least some kind of traction, because up until that point, after Kendrick released 616 and released Euphoria, you know, the chatter already at that point was that Drake started something that he wasn't going to be able to finish. So when he released Family Matters, that was supposed to be the track that sort of was supposed to equalize the balancing scale. The reason why that doesn't work is that it was definitely that same day. But anyway, quicker than anybody ever expected, when Drake releases that song, the Family Matters song, Kendrick responds that same day with the song called Meet the Grahams. And in this song, it is a pretty brutal song, in the sense that, one, he brings his children into this. He talks about the son that we already know about, the son that Drake a few years ago basically hid. And then Kendrick goes on to allege that not only did he hid his first son, Adonis, he also implies that Drake has a secret second child, who's like a girl who's like 11 years old. But that's probably like the least interesting part of the story. In this part, he also basically directly addresses Drake's parents. He talks to his mother, he talks to his father. And when he's talking to both his parents, he's basically talking about how they've done a terrible job with Drake, who he calls Aubrey because that's his real name. And then he talks about the reason why he says they've done a terrible job is because they basically raised a monster who's a predator, who makes it unsafe for young girls to be around. And in the record, the reason why it's so ugly is not just the kinds of things he's accusing Drake of, is that he also says that he wishes him to die. And I think he says this like at least two times. And I've never heard people, I mean, I've heard it in like punk or rock music where they're like, you know, when they just talk about like wanting their parents to die or talking about death in general. But I've never heard it in this way. And in this way, it kind of felt like he meant it. To me, when I heard it, I felt like he said that with his whole chest. So, I mean, I personally kind of, I didn't like that much, because it's one thing participating in a rap beef where it kind of feels lighthearted, in the sense that, you know, people are exchanging mean words. So it's not like they're fighting. It's not like there's weapons. It's not like anybody's life is in danger. It's basically like an exchange of like spoken word. And I guess when I first heard the lyrics, when he said, you know, I want you to die, I wish you would die. And he said it, you know, with a gravel to his tone, of voice, I thought, ooh, like this is quite an escalation. But I guess I was kind of conflicted in the sense that, you know, the things that he's accusing Drake of are very serious things. And if I believe those things are very serious, then I guess what he wishes of Drake is proportionate to what he's accusing of Drake, if that makes sense. So, you know, I kind of tried to square it up in my mind in that way. So anyway, after that song is released, Kendrick comes back 24 hours later and he comes out with like an absolute banger. When I say I have listened to this song like 100 times easily since it came out, I really have. So he releases this song, Not Like Us. And I swear I actually start my day with this song. I end my day with this song. When I'm walking to work, when I'm on break, when I feel like I need a pep me up. I don't know why it's like such a good tune. So anyway, he releases this song, Not Like Us. And in that song, I mean, he's saying the same things. He said the same things consistently throughout the 4 or 5 songs he released. He's saying, you're a predator, you're a pedo, our children and daughters aren't safe around you. The difference between this song and the other songs, though, is that the other songs are really, I don't know how to say it, they're deep songs, or they're songs where the music is not necessarily catchy throughout. And actually, he has like, it's basically like 3 songs within a song for at least 2 of the songs. So because he changes like the beat and changes the music. But the songs very much require you to be an active listener. They require you to listen to the lyrics, to connect to the lyrics, to understand what he's saying. And I don't know if people are invested in dedicating that much time, because some of the stuff, you have to also know something about Kendrick. You have to have followed the beef between Kendrick and Drake closely, and also just know a lot of like hip hop references that you probably don't know unless you're like a hip hop head, I guess you would say. And I would fall into that category, although I did make the time to look at the lyrics, because, you know, I did become obsessed. So anyway, this song, though, the Not Like Us song, is just radically different to the first few songs, because this song, you know, you get what he's saying without having to dig deeply into what the lyrics are. And on top of that, like, just the music is just banging. I don't know how else to say it. Like, it's just a good tune. It's like a good summer tune. It's energetic. It just has a lot of energy. And he says what he's been saying, but he says it simpler, I guess you could say, and he says it to a really good background. And if Kendrick hadn't already won, which he had, this was basically like the nail in the coffin. Like there was kind of like, Drake would have had to come out with something out of this world, something spectacular, something unexpected, just something that I just don't think that Drake has the skill set to be able to produce. So after the song, it was kind of a wrap. I mean, Drake came out with a song afterwards called The Heart. And also, actually, let me rewind for a second. The reason why Drake took the L on this beef is not just because it really showed that lyrically, in terms of just his vocal capacity, because sometimes people make it seem as though rap isn't also about the way that somebody's voice sounds. It also is about voice quality. It is also about intonation. It is also about being able to perform to a rhythm and having variation and having good lyrics and having an understanding of how to hype people up through the way that you use words. It's a real art form. And he took the L because when you compared, even if you just closed your eyes, even if you just didn't really think deeply about the words that they were both saying, if you just listened to how Kendrick sounded versus how Drake sounded, you could just hear that Kendrick was the artist. Kendrick was the person who knows how to use words to communicate. It sounds really simple, but he knows how to use words to communicate, to incite a feeling in you. He makes it sound good. He has variation in his tonality, in the way that he uses like different phrases, in the way that he uses different phrases against different beats, in a way that just makes the music come alive. And Drake, in comparison, felt very vanilla, felt very soulless. And it really exposed, like when you listen to them side by side, even just like the voice quality and the quality of the rapping, you could just tell that Drake is just not a rapper. Secondly, one of the things that I feel like was underappreciated about the beef was that Kendrick also put a great deal of effort in just the bare, just like the music quality, in that in Euphoria, in Meet the Grahams, in Not Like Us, all those songs featured multiple beats. It wasn't just like the same beat or the same music and he was rapping over the same beat. It was effortful, if that's a word. You can tell he made an effort. You could tell there was complexity there. You could tell it wasn't just about retaliating against Drake. It also felt like he wanted to take pride in the music that he produced. And actually, taking it back one step, one of the odd notes, or one of the many odd notes about Drake's behavior in the beef, or what became evident, I guess you could say, was that when Kendrick initially comes out and accuses him of being a predator, specifically being a pedophile, because he's pursued very young girls, Drake, for some reason, thinks that he can respond to the other less inflammatory accusations. So when it was either Meet the Grahams or it was in Euphoria. In Euphoria, when the first time Kendrick comes out and is accusing Drake of all these things, he accuses him in very explicit terms. He's not holding back. He's not beating around the bush. He says, "You are a predator." It was basically like the anthem of the song. And when Drake comes back with Family Matters, instead of addressing that, like, you know, directly and head on, because that's all that's on everybody's mind, he thinks he can come back and basically address, like, he basically decides to focus on the secret child component. When Kendrick accuses Drake of having a secret daughter, an 11-year-old daughter, he also accuses Drake in the same record of being a predator. And for some reason, Drake makes the calculation in his head that the addressing the daughter part is more important than addressing the pedophile allegation, you know, which in retrospect obviously was a big tactical mistake. Now, when I zoom out of the beef and I try to think about why I was so obsessed with it, or why, you know, not even just me, why just the public in general took such a liking to it, took such an interest in it, to the point where, you know, and I guess part of this is just the algorithm. Obviously, the more you like something or you watch certain content, the more that content is shown to you. But even outside that, you know, they definitely were trending on TikTok in a very big way. And then also just in terms of Spotify, they were like the most streamed artist for the couple of months that the beef was at its peak. When I think about why people were interested, when I think about why I was interested, I mean, on a superficial level, you know, Drake is one of the biggest pop artists of our time right now. I mean, I don't think he's going to be here in like 15 years time. I don't think he's going to like make it into the Hall of Fame in the way that Michael Jackson did, or the way that Prince did. But certainly he has left an imprint. So the fact that he was engulfed in this beef is interesting enough in the sense that he has a big platform already. But from my perspective, I've always felt that Drake is... he's just always given me the ick, you know, even without knowing a lot about his music. Because for me, I tend to know people through interviews. And then if I like their interviews, I will go and look at their music or listen to their music or look or watch their shows or watch their movies. But I tend to discover people through like other mediums that are outside like their core, the core way they make money. So with Drake, it was kind of like the same thing. I saw him in interviews and I read articles about him long before I ever watched his music videos or listened to his music. And from what I initially felt was, he just gave me the ick, you know. And it wasn't just like seeing him being snubbed by Rihanna in 2016, which is I think when the first time he was on my radar. Just seeing somebody being publicly snubbed in that way kind of makes you look at both people with curiosity. So the person doing the snubbing, you think, oh, like, you must really dislike this person or not respect this person, or you must have a deep-seated beef with this person to embarrass them in such a public way. And when somebody embarrasses somebody intentionally in such a public way, either that person is just a complete, you know, nasty person, shall we say, who just goes around hurting people for no reason, Or you sometimes think maybe the person did something to have it coming. Already I was suspicious of Drake because I was thinking, for a woman to snub you in such a public way, you've probably done some things to kind of warrant that behavior. Outside of the snubbing at the VMAs, I also noticed, you know, I'd read articles about how, not just read articles, but I would just see him pop up everywhere. And I would see him pop up everywhere next to a very famous woman. And to me, when people, specifically men, are seen with like dozens and dozens and dozens of women in a way that isn't platonic, like in all these pictures he makes it very clear that either they have been intimate or they have dated or they're about to be intimate, like there's a leery smile or a leeriness about the way that he is in these pictures that kind of feels like he's showing up for his boys, or he's trying to make the public or the people who are seeing these images know that he has been intimate with these people. It almost feels like he's showing off. And to me, that's really icky because, you know, it's undignified in the sense that, one, it's why kiss and tell? Like, that's a very childish thing to do. And second, you know, it's much more attractive when men in particular are intimate with people and they just don't kiss and tell. They're very secretive. They are very discreet, shall we say, because we both know that when women are connected with too many partners, it often taints the woman in the way that it doesn't taint the man. With the man, he basically is kind of like, you know, tapped in the back or high-fived because he's been able to get with many women. Whereas with the women, you know, especially when the man doesn't like claim them, or the relationship doesn't progress into being like a real relationship and it feels as though it was just sort of like a sexual interaction, you know, to some extent she's a little bit tainted negatively by the exchange or the experience. So the fact that he was just going around being photographed with all these women in a way that kind of like robbed them of their dignity somewhat, you know, kind of made me think that he's probably not a nice like partner at the very least to date. And I would contrast that with like, you know, a bachelor we've known for a very long time. When you think about George Clooney, who's been a bachelor before he married, I think his wife's called Amal. Before he married his wife, he was a bachelor for like 40 years. You know, this guy was running the streets in the sense that, you know, he wasn't married. He wasn't attached to anybody publicly. But you obviously know that he was dating people because he's George Clooney. But at no point did you really get the sense that he was showing the world all his conquests, or that he was sort of like parading the women that he was intimate with publicly so that he could get like, I guess, popularity points or props for the fact that he'd been with these people. Whereas when you look at pictures with Drake, where he's with Serena Williams or Lopez or whoever he was dating at the time, there's this feeling that there's a joke that the women that are photographed with him aren't in on. Outside him just being like a womanizer or somebody who just uses women for like clout, he also, one of the things that stands in my mind is one of the first things I read about him, which probably tainted my experience, was that he had dated Georgia Smith. And Georgia Smith was a very young, up and coming British songstress, very sultry music, kind of forgettable actually, but anyway, she was up and coming at the time, and at the time she was a teenager. And I remember reading that they had been seen in a coupley way when she was like, okay, I feel like it was like 16, 17, but people say it was like 20. But I swear at the time when I saw it, she was a lot younger than 20 years old. But even if we say she was 20 years old, at the time Drake was in his early 30s. So still weird / creepy behavior. So, you know, the short of it is I didn't have a good impression. And with Kendrick, you know, I knew some things about Kendrick. I knew that back in my university days, I met people who were just obsessed with Kendrick. Like, they felt like he was like the second coming of Christ. They felt like he was the second coming of Tupac. And they felt like he was just a conscious rapper who had really profound lyrics and had something to say. So because of that, because he just came so recommended, I was like, okay, I'll give it a chance. I'll give it a shot. And I listened to some of his albums and I liked the albums. He's very decorated. He's won like 17 Grammys. He's won like a Pulitzer Prize. Like, he's just somebody who's very respected for his lyricism and for his thoughts and the way that he translates his thoughts into music. And despite all that, despite that I know all that, I wouldn't necessarily say that the music that he produces is like my go-to music. I've got very crappy taste in music. I like pop music. I like cheesy pop music. I like rap as well, but I tend to like sort of like pop rap, I guess you could say. And I also am not a big fan of like vulgar music. Not because I'm a prude, but it probably is because I'm a prude. It's just not my cup of tea. Like, my sister recently introduced me to Sexy Red. And honestly, when I was listening to it at the office, I felt filthy. I felt like, ooh, like, are people going to listen, like, hear that I'm listening to this? Is this affecting my mental health? And also, like, is it just sort of degrading my brain? Because, you know, sometimes when you're listening to stuff, you think, I like the way it's making me feel. I like that it's hyping me up, but at the same time, I know that it's actually not good for me. And that's the way I feel with music like that. So going back to the Kendrick and Drake Lamar, some people sort of were invested in the beef because they fundamentally felt that the clash was between real artistry on Kendrick's side and basically sort of diluted, cheesy, soulless pop music. And the reason why they were defending Kendrick so heavily was because they were basically advocating for the return of conscious music, of music that doesn't degrade the mind, music that more effort is put into and the person feels like they are invested in the quality of their music. I honestly wasn't coming from it from that perspective. Not particularly ideologically aligned to Kendrick. I respect the fact that he, you know, really cares about his craft. I respect the fact that he makes an effort to produce conscious music. I respect the fact that he doesn't exploit, you know, just like the black audience and to produce all the stuff that is just really poison for them. So I respect him from that level, but I'm not like a diehard Kendrick fan. I'm not like an ideologue, and that's not the reason why I was invested in the beef. I was mostly invested in the beef because I disliked Drake, and the enemy of my enemy is my friend. But as I sort of delved deeper into it, and I went deeper into the obsession, I was reading all these articles, I was watching all these videos, I was listening to all these analyses, I kind of was able to crystallize what it is about the beef that intrigued me. And I guess for me, it's a human story, as usually that's the thing that interests me in most things. It's a human story. And I think what most people disliked about Drake, or what, you know, there's loads of things, you know, like, a part of me wants to believe the reason why people are so invested in the Drake and Kendrick beef is because they are outraged that somebody who's been accused of being a predator can continue to make money and continue to sort of operate the way he always operated. And it's sort of like an act of activism to kind of bring awareness to the wider public about the fact that this person's a predator. Like, maybe that's what it is, but I don't think that's what it really is. I think at its core, I think most people, what they feel about Drake, even when they like his music, and many people do like his music, they like his music, but they sense at the core that he is not authentic, that he's not an authentic person, that he's not being himself, and that he talks about things that aren't his experience. And when you spend like a few minutes just looking at Drake's past, like, that is just so self-evident. Like, I watched like a 30-minute YouTube video from 10, maybe 15 years ago, where Drake is back in Toronto. And for anybody who doesn't know, like, he grew up in Canada. He's biracial. His dad is black, his mom is white. And his parents split when he's very young, and he ended up living with his mother, and his mother was his primary caretaker. And, you know, it's contested whether he had like a lot of contact with his dad or not. His dad says they did have contact. He says that his dad was kind of like a deadbeat, but not in those terms. And essentially, he grows up in Canada with his mother, and he grows up in a very well-to-do neighborhood. Like, it's a gated community. And when you look at the video that I saw and pictures in general, it's just a very snazzy place. So he grows up in Canada with his mother. And when he's a teenager, he ends up like landing a show on the show called Degrassi, which is a popular show in Canada featuring teenagers going through high school, basically. And he ends up being on that show for 7 years. And the video that I saw must have been recorded during this period, because he looks very young and he references the show. But the video is basically like taking us on a tour of his home. And the home is beautiful. Like, the kind of home that has like 7-8 bedrooms, that has like a basement that's like like an MTV kitted out sort of basement. If you used to watch MTV when they used to do like My Crib, and it's just beautiful, like beautiful floors, beautiful furniture. Like it just feels like the place has money. So he shows us his grandmother and he's being playful with his grandmother. His grandmother's like this elderly, like white lady who's like, you know, just like thinks Drake is like this cheeky kid, you know, cheeky teenager. He's showing us his grandmother and they're like playing around. Then he shows us his mother. Then he's like, okay, guys, follow me. And he shows us the rest of the house. And that's when we see, you know, how nice the house is. And really the net takeaway from this video that I took was that he was a privileged kid. He came from a well-to-do, even if he wasn't like in the higher echelons of society, because that wasn't the case. He just came from like a good family, a well-off family. And the thing is, you know, there's actually nothing wrong with that. In fact, that's a really nice thing. Like the ideal, what we would wish for everybody is for everybody to have that kind of start, the kind of start where they've got a stable home life, where they're able to have the things that they want and need, for them to have abundance in their life, for them to have opportunities. All those things are perfectly acceptable and perfectly okay. And it doesn't mean that that person can't participate in the Black experience, because sometimes people make it seem as though the Black experience is like all about struggle. Like if you didn't grow up in the projects, if you didn't start from zero, if you didn't have to fight for everything that you have, that somehow that diminishes your identity as a Black person. But obviously that's not true. Like, it's a very expansive identity. It has room for all kinds of experiences. It's not a monolith. And so the idea that Drake would have to erase his identity and diminish the things that he had, or underplay the things that he had, or misrepresent the kind of lifestyle that he had for him to be able to participate in Black culture, in Black music, and in hip hop in general, it's kind of a perverse thing. And the reason why I think it's problematic, and the reason why I think it's at the core of what has gotten him into this entanglement with Kendrick, and also put him at odds with the music industry, or at least the Black segment of the music industry at large, is that, you know, that industry actually comprises people, or is made up of people, who have had those experiences that Drake tries to embody or pretend to have had. So there are people who did start at zero, who did live in the projects, who did have to fight for everything that they have. And if that is their experience, watching somebody like Drake pretend as though that was the case when they know that that isn't the case, of course it's going to be very infuriating. And the thing about appropriation that is annoying and upsetting, so it isn't just somebody putting on like your cultural heritage or things that represent your cultural heritage. It is actually the misrepresentation or the making light of what you take seriously. It's kind of like when people put on like the bindi, you know, like the mark on the middle of the forehead that Indian people put on, and they put it on as a costume, like, oh, like this will be cute with my outfit, or this is Halloween, or I'm going to this function that's going to be like diverse or interesting or artsy. Let me put that in my forehead. The reason why that's insulting is that for that person who's appropriating it, it's essentially like a look, it's a costume, it's drag, it's something they're putting on because it feels cool to them, it feels interesting to them, but there's no depth and there's no connection. And because there's no depth and there's no connection to the people receiving that person, that person who's put on that costume, whether it's a bindi or whether it's, you know, another thing, it feels as though they're putting on a costume, and it feels as though they're trivializing something that is important to somebody else. And that's kind of what it feels like with Drake. It kind of feels like he's putting on, and obviously when you know his background and you know the life that he led, he had no rough edges. And therefore when he is seen in videos and he's kind of depicting a life that he didn't have, he's showing himself in like rough neighborhoods in the projects, he's acting all tough, he's, you know, kind of implying that he was part of gangs, or that he has killed people, or he could kill people. He's just clearly pretending to be something that he is not. And he's pretending to have led a lifestyle or have had access to a lifestyle that he didn't have. And the thing is, it isn't just a lifestyle that he's claiming to that he didn't have. He's also diminishing people's real trauma. So when we hear rap artists talking about their experiences and talking about growing up in poverty, for example, or talking about the things that they had to do to survive, or talking about watching their mother struggle and feeling helpless to help, or having to engage in violence to be able to survive. Although they're not using the language of trauma, that is exactly what they're describing. They're describing traumatic experiences that have shaped who they are right now. Experiences where they've had to witness things that they shouldn't have witnessed at that age, or having to go through struggles that have been character-defining struggles. So they may not be using vulnerable language, but that is still what's happening. They are still relaying to us traumatic experiences that they went through. So the idea that somebody who hasn't had those experiences, like Drake, kind of putting on that costume and those experiences for financial gain, of course is going to be problematic to the people in the industry who genuinely have had those experiences. Outside making money and therefore claiming money that probably should be going to somebody else, like, if Drake is telling other people's stories and other people's experiences and making money from telling other people's experiences and stories, it kind of implies that he's taking money from other people who should be making money from those experiences, because those experiences are true to those people. So he's taking money from other people. And on top of that, the thing about being an inauthentic person or having inauthenticity as part of sort of how you walk through life is that it repels people for many reasons. One of the reasons that fundamentally it's an act of dishonesty, like you are misrepresenting who you are. And because you're misrepresenting people, like who you are, people don't feel like they can trust you, because even if they can't pinpoint exactly what you are lying about, we've all had the experience of walking away from somebody and thinking, there's something odd about that person, or something about the exchange with that person felt as though they were lying to me. So that's what happens when you're being inauthentic. You're walking around and you're misrepresenting who you are. And whether you know it or not, other people sense that in you and it repels them. The second reason why it repels them, that it kind of implies a lack of confidence in who you actually are. So if Drake is embodying this lifestyle and these personas, and he therefore thinks that those personas are more valuable, more interesting, more worthy of bringing to the table, it must mean that he doesn't think very highly of who he, like what his authentic self is, what his own experiences were. And that's why he has the need to embody all these other experiences and pretend to be somebody who he is not. So that is always going to repel people, because a lack of confidence implies that the person is needy, or if not needy, like doesn't like themselves, you know, doesn't like themselves at the very least enough to bring themselves or their true selves into these situations and these interactions. And also it's just embarrassing. Like sometimes we forget that people see us moment to moment over time. And sometimes when we are busy pretending to be somebody else, because it's exhausting to pretend to be something you're not, it's exhausting because you have to remember who you're playing, essentially, the things you said before, how you're supposed to be coming across, it's mentally draining, it's emotionally draining. And therefore, there are periods of time when we're not going to be able to keep it up, because it is so exhausting. And that's probably what happens when you are an artist masquerading as a different kind of artist. So really, you're like a light pop artist, but you're masquerading as like a hardened like hip hop artist, and therefore you're gonna have to expend a lot of energy maintaining that persona and maintaining that lie. And every now and again people are gonna catch you slipping, because you can't be on full time, you can't maintain that lie 24/7. So people are going to observe one version that you've presented of yourself, and then when your guard is down, when you're tired of pretending, they're going to observe the true version of yourself. And because those two people are going to be so different, they're not going to be able to reconcile those two personalities. And the conclusion that they're going to draw from you and from experiencing you in those different circumstances is that you're somebody not to be trusted, because you're somebody who is not consistent. And one of the final things I'll say just about this before I move on to why it's relevant to just, you know, us regular people, is that one of the takeaways, one of the things I observed about the Kendrick and Drake beef is that it was kind of sad and odd that nobody came out to defend Drake. So while Kendrick, you know, at his pop-out concert, which I watch with interest, or just on Twitter and TikTok and other platforms, like, you know, people defended him. They posted videos of Drake being, you know, predatory or weird. They liked his comments. They commented on the song. They commented on the beefs. They showed up to his concert. They it was kind of clear that they took his side. The same was not evident where Drake is concerned. It really was deafening silence from his camp. Like, even of all the people that he's collaborated with in the past, his mentors, like, nobody came out and said, you know, leave Drake alone, or Drake is not this person that you accuse him of. Like, there was nothing. Which means that either the accusations that Kendrick has levied against Drake are kind of well known within the industry, and that's why people aren't willing to attach their names to Drake. Or the other thing that he said, that Kendrick said about Drake, is true, in that he has created a lot of enemies in the industry because he moves in ways that are very disloyal, in ways that alienate fellow musicians. And actually, throughout the course of the beef, we've seen some of this, like, disloyalty be brought up. So people have said how he sleeps with, you know, many people's girlfriends. Even his mentor, Lil Wayne, even when Lil Wayne was in prison, he ended up sleeping with Lil Wayne's long-term partner. So again, an act of disloyalty. The people have also said that he steals artists' music. So I know The Weeknd came out and they said that in the very early days of their career, you know, OVO or Drake's record was trying to sign The Weeknd. And through the midst of that relationship, they basically sort of coerced more than half of the songs that The Weeknd had intended to produce or release for themselves. OVO or Drake essentially took those songs without, I mean, The Weeknd gave it to them, but it was very much a coerced situation. And then also, if he is willing to sleep with other people's girlfriends and partners, and if he's willing to steal people's music or coerce them to give them their music when they're new budding artists that don't have a lot of agency and a lot of leverage, then it's not really a leap to assume that he probably screws them over financially as well. And for me, you know, that has to be at least a big part of the explanation, because people kind of reap what they sow. Like, if you're a loyal person who treats people well, who produces good work for people, who makes people feel comfortable, who doesn't alienate people, then there's no reason why people wouldn't be on your side if you're a nice person. And if nobody is on your side, it implies that you're probably not a nice person. And if it isn't just a question of niceness, then in my view, it's kind of worse. It also implies that people don't respect you, because if they did respect you, they presumably would be willing to stake their careers or stake their reputation in defending you because you're somebody who is worthwhile respecting. And actually, this kind of makes me think about the Chris Rock and Will Smith slap, where Chris Rock slaps Will Smith at the Oscars and it was like a big thing. And Will Smith ended up kind of being excluded from the Oscars for like the next, I think it's like the next 15 years or 10 years. But one of the odd things about that experience or that exchange was that even though people were angry or disappointed with Will Smith's behavior, because it's just not something, it's just not his brand, you know. His brand is very lovey-dovey, conscious, responsible, socially aware. Even though people were disappointed in Will's behavior, like, people generally weren't supportive of Chris Rock. Like, they weren't necessarily outraged for him or sympathetic with him, or there wasn't like a huge mobilizing to sort of like prop up Chris Rock and say, you know, we're here for you and we're going to sort of like cancel Will Smith on your behalf. And somebody put it really well in that people like Chris Rock's comedy, but they don't respect Chris Rock. I think at least part of this goes back to like this really wild video that you can still probably find on YouTube, where Chris Rock is sitting at an interview, and at the interview he's with like fellow comedians. One of them is definitely Louis C.K., who I think is canceled. It's Louis C.K. and then it's also Ricky Gervais, and it's like two other comedians, all of them white. He's sitting at the table and Ricky Gervais ends up making a joke and he uses the N-word. And then one of the other comedians also like laughs along and says the N-word as well. And Chris Rock, the only black person there, doesn't put them in their place, doesn't correct them, doesn't say like what is going on there. He allows them to say the N-word repeatedly in his presence. And it very much gives the impression that in his private life, that when they're, you know, together unobserved, that's probably the dynamic that goes ahead. And when you combine that with the fact that a lot of Chris Rock's jokes, when you really like analyze it, like I'm a big fan of trying to understand who the butt or who the, like who's supposed to be laughed at and who is doing the laughing in comedy skits, a lot of his jokes, the like black people are actually the butt of the joke, which isn't, which, you know, kind of gives you an insight into his mind, into his psychology. And when you connect that to seeing this black man on stage with these white comedians using the N-word around him and him just laughing along, you know, it's not somebody that you respect. It's not somebody who you're going to come out and defend if things go wrong. And with Drake, it kind of feels like that. It kind of feels like somebody who produces like stuff that people engage with, like they like his music, like they'll bop to his music, they'll dance to his music, they'll put it on when they're driving, they'll dance to it when it comes on at the club. It'll be background for like an event at the house, but that's not the same thing as actually respecting somebody, liking somebody, thinking highly of that person. And that's kind of what the beef revealed. It revealed that on the one hand, like Drake is really popular. He's played a lot. He's sold a lot of singles. His tours, you know, get great attendance, but he's not respected. Like people don't feel as though he is like, you know, like one of us, to quote Kendrick. It doesn't feel as though he belongs to us. It doesn't feel as though he is on our side or that we would kind of stick our heads out for him. Now, the thing that I felt like I learned from the Kendrick-Drake interaction is, you know, something I think about often. And the first thing is just the idea of authenticity and bringing your full self to just everyday experiences. Because there's a temptation, especially when you live in a world where you feel like it doesn't represent you or like you're the odd one out or you're the minority. It can feel as though it's easier to assimilate and conform and to sort of just blend with what the majority is doing and how the majority is behaving. In some way, it almost feels as though you kind of know what people want of you or what they expect of you. And sometimes it just feels easier to just give them what they want to see or what they want to have from you. Other times, the reason why we don't bring our authenticity or why we're not authentic about who we are and bring our full selves to, you know, just our lives and our work lives and our intimate lives and our, you know, friendship lives, is that sometimes we feel as though our true selves aren't acceptable or they're not lovable or they're not worthy of respect. And therefore, we kind of feel as though the most expedient thing for us to do, for us to have a shortcut to that love and acceptance and respect, is sort of by mirroring the people in our lives. And the thing about going through life, mirroring other people or taking on what the majority is doing or thinking or feeling, is that in one-to-one interactions with people, they always sense that something is off with you. In the same way that you sense it as well. Like when you meet somebody and you're talking to somebody and you're asking them questions, you're engaging with them, and somehow you feel as though you walk away from the conversation having learned nothing about that person. Or if you were to describe that person in a few words, you couldn't even think of any adjectives to describe them because honestly, they brought so little of themselves to that table or to that interaction. What you feel is that there's something off about them. And that's the exact same way when we're walking around being inauthentic or walking around every day mirroring the people in our lives because we think that they are the more acceptable version of who to be. And therefore, if we are them, then we're going to be liked by others who like that person we're mirroring, or we're going to be accepted by the group because we're basically mirroring one of them. Maybe sometimes that works, but the long effect of that is that they never quite know who you are, because even if they like or they are flattered by the fact that you're mirroring them or pretending to be them or have obviously put them on a pedestal of what the ideal is, they're never going to really know you. And because they never get to really know you, they're never going to really trust you. And because they never get to trust you, it's unlikely that you're going to for example, get promotions or reach a level of intimacy with that person, because intimacy requires intimate knowledge of that person. And you can't, if you're walking around not being yourself and sort of portraying what you think other people want to see, then you're never going to be known by other people. So honestly, there's no point. Like, you might as well bring yourself to the table. And it doesn't mean like going into situations and just being like the reckless version of you. It doesn't mean like if you like to spend all day in pajamas, you should go to work in pajamas. Or if you, you know, are a gossip, you should go to work and gossip. It doesn't mean that. It just means like, if you're a funny person, bring some of that humor into your everyday life. If you're somebody who likes meaningful conversations, then try and have meaningful conversations with people. If you're somebody who is silly or lighthearted or jokey, then it's okay to bring some element of that into your everyday life, because restricting or stifling or pretending to be somebody you're not, not only is it draining emotionally and psychologically to you, it also just alienates people and makes people feel as though there's something that they can't quite pinpoint with you, that they can't quite figure out about you, or that you're an unknown quantity because they feel as though you don't bring your authentic self and therefore they never get to know you. And actually, one more thing I learned as a bonus is we should all be careful about creating enemies unnecessarily, because the thing about people is that they don't forget how you make them feel. So you might think that they've moved on, but people are really petty and they're children at heart. And sometimes loose words or irresponsible words leave a bigger scar than we think. And although those people may not say things out loud, or they may not call you out in the moment, or they may not challenge what you said to them, they are nevertheless going to wait for their opportunity to get their revenge or lick back or retaliation. And in this case, in Drake's case, obviously the people that he had slighted over the years, that he had betrayed over the years, they were either waiting, you know, quietly for their opportunity for when they would be able to exact revenge, or they got their revenge by not speaking up for him, by not coming to his defense or his aid. And unfortunately for Drake in this situation, the things that Kendrick has accused him of are the kinds of things that you really do need allies to come out and defend your character, because the only way for his character to be rehabilitated is by people who are perceived as being upstanding, as being good people, to come out and say, hey, that's my friend and I know that he would never do something like that. And I very much get the sense that clearly that's not going to happen for Drake, because it very much feels as though he's reaping what he sowed. So one thing I've learned for sure is that's not going to happen to me. You know, I'm going to, you know, approach the week by being good to people, by bringing my full self to, you know, just everyday interactions. And I hope you're able to do the same as well. So with that wraps up this week's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I'll catch you on the next one.